I've got the blues, longing for her company. It's many miles from where I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be a guest. Railroad train, a good old pal to me. Take me everywhere I want to go, get my transportation free.
This is Dave Monk, Prairie Monk, WEFT, Champaign, 90.1, your FM dial.
And Dave on the board.
And wow, winter wonderland yesterday. I couldn't believe it. All that sticky snow sticking on the leaves, and some of the leaves still green, and some of them on the ground as a result of wind. But rather beautiful, and we should take time to enjoy. I watched children playing, and I thought that was rather a wonderful experience. I talked to my brother in Australia, and he had had a similar experience with snow in their area, which is very, very seldom. But I had looked at the streets, and the cracks in the concrete were retaining the snow, whereas the broad base of the concrete slabs were warm enough that they melted the snow immediately. And that segment, you have to wonder what it was that was making it more cool. It was probably the insert between the two slabs of concrete. But there are sorts of little things that you observe and hope that others will observe and enjoy, just little differences that make life interesting. This week I want to deal with a few memorials. We don't encounter all the people who do tremendously interesting things, but we encounter people who are fairly public, and we encounter people who are environmental or oriented to some of the things we do. Tim Nugent was a powerhouse in disability education. It had been traditional for people who were disabled to sort of disappear into the back room of a house or into an institutional situation where they were kind of regarded as not able to do things. But Tim grew up in Pennsylvania in 1922, sometime there, and he had helped to raise his siblings, and he joined World War II, was injured, and had associations with disabled people. Eventually, he got to put together a disabled rehabilitation education situation in Galesburg, Illinois, where the university at that time had a unit. They pulled out of that unit, and Tim felt that the disabled program should go elsewhere, probably best being at the University of Illinois. But the University of Illinois was not too excited to have disabled people on campus. And so it took Tim a long time to work through that sort of culture and to get funding for his program. Occupied one of a number of army houses that were on the west side of the Memorial Stadium. There's probably about 15 acres of these rows of army buildings that were put there after World War II so GI Bill people could have a place to live. They were pretty rugged. You lived on top of each other. The walls were rather cardboard, as I remember. And people were marrying and having families, so there were lots of children. It was called Fertility Row. And so Nugent had one or two of these huts, and he had a ramp. And ramps were not well known in those days. Tim used to make them in his backyard, in his garage. And so he started what was a rehabilitation center that eventually morphed into being DEES, a disability organization that's formally recognized. His students often had talents, but they came not knowing what their talents were because they'd lost an arm or a leg, or often war injuries. Today, some of the disabled people are more likely to have an associated disability that has a foot in a brain or something like that. But was an era when people were having to learn what their bodies were like and what they were able to do. So Tim would have a rather rigorous orientation session, and he would get his students to go to physiology classes just so that they could discover what their abilities were. And that was rather helpful. His students had to back and do very well, because otherwise his program would not be very effective. He was in charge of the DEES program for 35 years. He was 92, I think, when he died, but he was forever in retirement, very much associated with the disability program. The dean of the college spoke of him. He was rather pushy. He was a little ornery sometimes, but he got things done. He didn't get a lot of funding from the University of Illinois, so he raised money on his own part, and that was somewhat an embarrassment. Do you go outside the university to get your money, and why? Well, provide us with some money. Eventually he got money to do that, but before that he was knocking on doors, and he had developed a strength outside the university which was quite considerable, including giving a keynote address in Sweden, where there was a fairly up-to-date disability program. And so that alerted the university to the fact that he did have some clout and some ideas. He was interested in sports and how the people could use their ability. He started wheelchair football, wheelchair basketball. They had square dances in wheelchairs. And he continued that throughout his life. And actually, on his deathbed, he was worried that there was a move afoot to allow able-bodied people to be in wheelchairs and play wheelchair football and basketball. And he was opposed to that till the last. So, with a little bit of power from outside, Tim Nugent put in ramps, got cities across the country and across the world to put in ramps so people could be accessible to their houses, to their businesses, but also to their streets. And that was quite an achievement. He took a team of people to South Africa, where there was a disabled pilot who'd been in a crash, and invited them there. The English had a program that he'd belonged to, and he invited the wheelchair people there. So it took 8 wheelchair people and 8 able-bodied people to move equipment and to understand the situations. Tom Jones, who was a WCIA sports person for many years, was one of these team members. And it was in an era of apartheid, so you couldn't have black community people in the same stadium as white people. When I came here, I had encountered these people because they were coming back from South Africa, and I was working with agricultural communications where a number of these people were employed. So Hadley Reed had a sympathy for this sort of situation, and broadcasters, and that those domains could be handled by people who had lost a hand in a or in an auger or something like some farm equipment, or didn't have able-bodied total background. He put together a national disabled game, which was not easy to organize. He passed his role on of 35 years in these to other speakers who are speaking of the things that Tim did. Tim was also speaking. This was in the Methodist Church, and it's on Duncan Road, looking over. It's the Pisota Moraine, looking over the outwashed plain creek that goes down to the Kaskaskia. And it's a fairly recent building. But interestingly, there are no pews. There are chairs that are movable, and the auditorium can be converted to a basketball field or have music events. I strongly suspect that Tim was a part of that. We knew Tim because he had married his Hawaiian wife, and we had Wesley Kuipo, who was Hawaiian. He dived into a pond in Hawaii, which is not uncommon to do, and hit a rock and disabled his spine. So we had him as an artist to draw for us. He was not able to move his hands very much, except sort of wiggle them. He couldn't put a ruler down and draw a line, for instance. He couldn't go out in the field because he didn't have any sweat glands anymore. If you pushed him along the road in his wheelchair and you hit a bump, his legs actually came up and did a jiggle. But that was good because that meant that he had some sensitivity in his lower body, and that prevented bed sores. So Wesley was not where we had our office, next to the curriculum lab. He was in the advanced computation building where he could take an elevator to a space, and he would draw from our photographs. So I took a mixed bag of Wesley's pictures to the visitation, and Jeanette knew who very well who Wesley was, and they have a hall named after Nugent and a lot of artifacts are there, including some of Wesley's drawings. He left for California after a while because the social service facilities were a little better there, and but also the two sons were knowledgeable of Wesley, and but there was a huge lineup, and eventually when it was finished, the chairs were rearranged for a memorial service, and that included the dean of the college and the previous director of D's, and the Tracy, one of the sons, directed the program. Also, Mark Brown, who is the pastor, but he's a fairly recent pastor, and he didn't really know Tim until this last year, and he really got to know Tim as a person. And so after the memorial service, it was Tim was speaking at the memorial service because he was on tape, and two big screens allowed us to watch. And the end taps was played, and then followed by Company B, which was a sort of rambunctious popular tune at the end of World War II. The Methodist Church is interesting. It's a fairly new church, and it's there on Dick Bobosh ground. Dick Bobosh donated the land, and after there was a generous meal and lots of friendly meetings and exchange of stories, I retreated to a little prairie that was outside. I'd been talking to the pastor, and this is a little set-aside area that is not necessarily native plants, but it very much could be. The pastor said that it is of concern to the attendees because it sort of looks on the weedy side, which is true. And there's a lot of other plants in there that are not native, and I photographed it quite a bit just because I feel for Dick Bowash, who allowed us to put 2.5 acres of prairie in at Lake Park on his ground, and it's in a location which is very nice. It looks out from the Pisota Moraine over the outwash plain, which 57 travels down, and it's a fairly logical place. So I hope that perhaps the church could help the preservation of prairie and the feeling of a concept of preservation in that little plot. And I'm trying to think how we can establish it. The most important thing is to have someone who will take over and care for it for a long time. It's axiomatic that if one person is involved in this sort of thing, and they pass on or move to another location, the prairie will lose out. It needs just that amount of attention that it needs some in perpetuity, and that's often hard to do. So I was talking to someone named Dink, who is a gardener, a master gardener, but I was encouraging him to think about master naturalists, that something might happen there. I walked across Kitty Corner, across the road. There's a prairie cemetery. It's a very small cemetery in the corner of the Willard Airport, and it's fenced off, but it's related. Some of the people that are in there know what we have been doing with prairie. One of them is a previous mayor of Savoy, and he would give us support to do things that wasn't easy for him to do. In fact, one member of the Savoy Village Board would each year we were given some support, he would object and not vote for that support. And then one day, mysteriously, some prairie plants appeared upon his seat. And it wasn't I that did that, but somebody was doing it and giving Putita a home. So there are lots of memories there. There's a borrow pit down by 57 where soil was taken out to raise crossover roads and clover leaves. But around that borrow pit is a lot of prairie. So this little road that has got an easement for power on it, but it goes down there. There's a house up the road that Wanda Bengashe moved the Savoy Railroad Depot to a location there. So as you go along Duncan Road, you get this rolling territory with outwash palmate drainage coming off of the hill, going down to the outwash plain. And so it's a rather nice place to be, and lots of memories there. I'm just looking at my notes for a moment. I think I wanted to say something about Charles Higgins. Every once in a while, the obituary page comes up with several columns for someone, and this was a person that was well known and well liked, and he was a very friendly person. Charles Higgins was also from that Depression era where it was hard to survive. His father was a coal miner. He was part of coal miner too, but they had a small farm, and Charles was associated with that, and he helped to raise 9 children. He was the eldest son or eldest child. And he did not go to school till he was 12. By the time he was 18, he was drafted into the army, went to Europe, became a specialist in repairing tanks and then delivering them to the front in Europe. So he was in many countries. Came back after the war and stayed with the army, went to Korea, and did some of the same sort of technical things. Eventually wound up at Chanute and was teaching technical things. He got 2 associate degrees at Parkland College and eventually was employed by the University of Illinois as an audiovisual instructor, teaching people how to use equipment in the classroom, but he also repaired equipment and was basically first of all in the College of Education, but then more campus-wide. he married Eve, and just that little story. You have to know that women often were in the background. These days, women are more in the front ground, but in his day, women were backup people. Same goes for Tim Nugent and his wife, very, very supportive, but not always recognized. So the era has changed some. But he left an imprint on the landscape that will be there for a long time. It'll be diffuse, you won't notice it, but he is remembered. Then there was William Smith. William Smith got together with a guy, and I forget his name, I think he was named Hall, but he was a professor of economics, was Hall, and Hall had worked with the Watchmakers Union, and they had a, and Smith was the sort of second in command, and they had a lab right on 6th Street opposite what was the 6th Street post office then. And they got together and started to change the way people were apprenticed in shop making. Often, if you were an apprentice in watchmaking, you had to actually make some watch parts, which never happened anymore because the watches came with inserts or the whole watch. They developed cleaning techniques which used ultrasound and lasers, and they invented a way of mechanics reaching equipment, whether it was an eyeglass to look into a watch or whether it was a small screwdriver or something. They had the elbow placed on a movable disc so that you could move your arm around in a semicircle and your hand would reach perhaps 20 or 30 tools, and you could do the same with your other hand. And that was innovative. And they started to morph into other small equipment. Eventually, Parkland College took this over as a program, and I'm not sure what its status is at the moment, but there are a lot of people who are employed in small equipment, sometimes micro equipment, that actually needs repair. We had Scott Wiley here this week, and he has got a repair office on Green Street, which repairs cell phones. So we can do with these sorts of repair people because they're really needed, and we lack them. Often we throw out the item because it's cheaper to buy a new one than to horse around with the old one. So Smith taught for a long time at Parkland College and then went off to be with his family, small equipment event in Pennsylvania. So these are people that you get to know. They're not necessarily in your field, but you applaud their energy and their difference. These are people who are getting new programs. And so Nugent, Higgins, and Smith were people we were remembering this week.
This might be a good time to jump in and point out this is WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, and this is the second to the last Sunday of November. Let's see, this would be the 22nd.
22nd.
Try it again. It's not the 1900s anymore. It's 2015.
So now I want to say something about the rail-to-trail movement. We've been talking some about meetings I went to in Iowa that were trail meetings. Basically, what Heartland Pathways has been doing has been working with the preservation of the biodiversity of the ecosystem. The fact that we're down to 0.01% of the original prairie that was here, and it's almost not enough to continue the genetic material that we need for the future. You have to remember that soybeans was not a crop for us until 1936. People had to go around the world to pick up glycine plants. Glycine is the botanical name for soybean. And to breed them, to get a soybean that was not bitter, it was productive in terms of the amount of seed it produced. It was had bacteria on its symbiotic rhizobacteria on its roots that allowed it to process nitrogen. And that plant was developed and eventually became a major crop in competition with corn. So we now have corn and soybeans, whereas previous to that we had corn. And so we are basically biologists, but we want to tell people about this, so we're also artists. David works with art in the sense of working with computers so that we can take this program and videotape it and drop in pictures and talk about the things we do. And we try to educate. This week there will be a farm meeting which deals heavily with the money that can be made from corn and soybeans. And it's at Bloomington. It's on the 24th. And it's run by the University Extension. And ag communication people are involved. But I almost want to remind those people that there is alongside their farmland a little corner or a railroad line or a road that houses some of our leftover remnant prairie. And those sites are tremendously endangered, because you can now these days back a cultivator right up onto them and put in a few more rows of. But I want people to put a value on conservation. The material that is there is far more valuable than the few rows of corn or soybeans that they'll get. So we have to try and educate about that. This year we've had people who have decided to plow right up to the ballast of our railroad beds and gain income from that when we have bought that land for its conservation purposes, and it's really worth much more than any row of corn. And so how do we change that? How do we take the law to someone that actually has dug us up totally and gained crop? The tremendous difficulty is that that's taken out all the microorganisms, all the small mammals, all the plants that we would preserve, and we're never going to get that back. You can replant a prairie, but it's never got the character of 6,000 years of integration, where species find a place on a moisture gradient or on a different soil type, or it's a pollinator, or there are bees and birds that are there. And so how do you approach something like a conference on making money from every inch of prairie soil, and remind people that there's something more than just the money in the product. There's also a need for some biodiversity. And if you're going to do biodiversity, you're going to have to breed plants and perhaps animals too from an ecosystem. But if the ecosystem is not there, you're deprived of that capacity to adapt your particular new plant or species to a Drummer and Flanagan soil, or to a Zinnia and a more skeletal soil, or to a swampy cordgrass in a swampland. So let's look at rail trails. You know that our basic principle is prairie preservation in this community. If it's other places, it's the habitat along the line that's been saved by railroad activities. Mostly the only remaining remnant habitat is along railroad lines, roads, and graveyards that haven't been looked after with constant mowing. We care about that, but trails can help us because they occupy the ballast that's got a prairie on either side. There's a tremendous temptation for that railroad bed to be invaded by roads. Roads came in after railroads and went usually parallel to the railroad. So they can very easily take over your prairie and widen the road into the only remaining prairie on our line. So that's kind of disappointing, but it's a fact of life. But we work with trails. Sometimes we work with re-railing. And we had an interest from the National Rails to Trails movement that brought us a journalist, Elizabeth Striano, and she came not knowing what we do. She and her husband came out of Midway Airport, drove south. I had them get off the highway at Kankakee and come past Loder and Paxton and look at prairie, not knowing quite what it was, but they stopped at Loder where they could see the plants and species that we were trying to preserve. And part of the principle of this visit was to see how Heartland Pathways preserves the dignity of associated natural history. Involved a lot of other people. We looked at the trail between Paxton and Rantoul, which is an old concrete road. We looked at our little pocket prairie at across the road from WEF, but we also looked at a 9-acre prairie at Rantoul. We tried to figure out how these things relate. We looked at the Kicker Trail from Urbana to Danville, and we went to the west side of Champaign and looked at the areas there. We didn't make a lot of stress on railroads, but in writing article, we made a glitch in leaving out a possible re-rail between White Heath and Seymour, which is part of trying to get a connection between the Monticello Railroad Museum, which has 7 miles of active line. Our 4 miles of railroad bed could be re-railed and join with 3 miles of active line that could be abandoned shortly and into Champaign. So We've talked about how these sorts of things relate to TIF districts and development of Champagne at a very rapid rate, gentrification. But we left out the company that is looking to rerail the 4 miles. It's the Champagne, Havana, and Western Railroad, named after the railroad that came through early on. All the railroads were heading west to see who could get across the country first, and this was no different. So it goes west to Havana, where there's a problem because you have to get across the river there. And so that's the Havana into the title. But we left that out, and so the Champagne, Havana, and Western Railroad opted and wrote a note so that we will have a correction to our rather helpful article that came out with photographs that are local. And but that was very good because it sort of indicated that this area has a lot of different alternatives. So you have a trail to Danville from Havana, but you also have the potential for a trail from Champaign to Decatur. You have the potential for rails and trails and greenways.
Yeah.
So I went to a railroad seminar on Friday afternoon to collect some maps that are associated with the C, H, and W, making contact with the rail trail movement. I am rather pleased with that because that takes us out of circulation as individual local places. It gives us some oversight, some breadth outside ourselves. It's a little bit like Tim Nugent going to Sweden, and you get some recognition outside that then gives you some recognition inside. So we need to follow up on this. So the Railroad Museum has had a whole slug of people who have initiated that Railroad Museum. And you wouldn't think a Railroad Museum was involved with prairie preservation, but it is. It's 7 miles, two trackages. First of all, they were on an old interurban bed, and then the main line closed out, so they bought 7 mile railroad bed. And we need to recognize that and to also recognize areas around, like the riparian corridor from Allerton Park to Mahomet. If you put in a canoe at Mahomet, you can take a canoe and it takes you all day to get down to Allerton Park. There are lots of snags in the river, but in the long run, we hope that there'll be a riparian corridor of actual land ownership so that you won't be violating any land rights by paddling down the river. There's Allerton Park, which is like the seventh wonder of the world for Illinois, and it's got biodiversity, it's got history, and it's an attraction. And more and more people who come to your site are wanting to know what makes you famous, what makes your site famous, what gives this area some character, and we have that, but we haven't always utilized it. So Piatt County is there, DeWitt County is there with the Clinton Power Plant Lake and Weldon Springs State Park. So we're going to be in contact with the Rail to Trail movement. We have some other difficulties. The track that goes down from White Heath to Shady Rest, which is 30 acres, which we had a lot to do with preserving, is on an embankment. So how do you keep the railroad people separate from the pedestrian people or the bicycle people? It's a concern. If you are in some countries, the railroads are so much a part of the transportation system that people actually ride on the top of trains, or that they're very much overloaded, and they walk on railroad beds, and it's generally understood that this is not really fast trackage. The trains stop every once in a while. You herd sheep off the line or cattle off the line, and it doesn't lead to a lot of horrendous situations. So how can you get an engine driver to drive a train down on an hourly schedule or on a schedule to Shady Rest and to the Sangamon River and across the associated creeks, Madden Creek, and up the moraine on the other side? How do you do that and have those two groups together? I would like to say that the train moves at, or can move at 5 miles an hour or even 2 miles an hour if necessary. And the walkers that more or less have to walk on the railroad bed because the embankment and bridges, that the two could be compatible. It's rather expensive. It's a luxury to have a one line for a train or a car and another line for people. It just needs to be some care, and it's possible to have two on the same track. So the rail-to-trail movement has had rails to trails. But then they have gotten one better. They've gone to rails with trails so that you can have an active railroad line with a trail on the side. Unfortunately, that takes out all the biodiversity that we're trying to preserve. The next step is to have rail and trail on the same bed. And so we have a long way to go, because you will know that on main lines where the traffic is 80 mile an hour, at level crossings, people can get killed. It's much safer, actually, than road transportation, where you have the same sort of problem. So how can we convince the railroaders, historic railroaders, to use the site sensibly, perhaps announce that on Saturday at 2 o'clock there will be a railroad line and you're not allowed to walk on the railroad? It may allow us to take a simulated Chautauqua group to what used to be a campground that was just 15 miles away from communities that could use it. Horses couldn't go much further than that. How can you take the train across a truss bridge and up the other side, and have it park, and have it not be a danger? We are probably 100 years from getting that sort of recognition and possibility. It also means railing with ties, and we don't have a lot of lumber anymore, and what's more, concrete ties have gotten to be somewhat more effective than wooden ties. So how do we re-rail, and how do we make a bed in between two tracks that allow people to walk down to Shady Rest? Fortunately, if you put ballast over the concrete ties. The concrete ties don't break down so quickly. So you still have steel on either side that can be a liability. But if we go to liabilities to the nth degree, we don't do anything. We just avoid the problem. I think it's much better to see how we can get down to Shady Rest with an active steam train or a historic diesel train at some stage. So we're talking back and forth, and we're trying to bring together railroaders and trailers and habitat. And the last few weeks has been positive. And it's almost advantageous to us that we had a glitch that didn't recognize the railroad and its work to remove trees from the railroad bed. They're invasive trees that have brought the they've come in after the railroad was abandoned. We bought it, and they've grown over. So people have chainsawed the trees and herbicided the stumps and mown the territory so that it can be used as a trail until such times as we put down rail. It takes a little bit of understanding to put that in perspective, and so the Champaign, Havana, and Western Railroad people have stressed their easement. They have a 25-foot easement on Heartland Pathways territory, and we didn't really say that, and I didn't catch that when I checked the article. So my fault for not quite catching that. I've sort of not done a lot with the railroad because it was seemingly a little different and rather complex. We were dealing with 3 miles of abandonment, which we would like to stay as active railroad line. It meant dealing with two different elevators, different elevator companies, with a possible purchase of the line by the elevator, the contract with Canadian National to keep the elevator afloat for at least 5 years at a price which is probably higher than would be normal if you were a super elevator like Cargill's that can ship out 100 cars at a time, whereas the little elevator might ship out 15 or 25 cars at a time. These decapitated railroad main lines don't make a lot of money for the railroads. So universally, they're being closed out unless we look at them from a multiple-use point of view. So I'm kind of glad we had a glitch that has been considered, and I think the rail trail movement will come by and give us some status that is beyond our local involvement. And so the suggestion is that we have Eric Olbag, who is the regional director for Rails to Trails, to come and speak to us. But I think before he comes to speak to us, we need to have him to know what it is we have. And that's difficult because it's long. It's best part of 100 miles of railroad bed. So evil-mindedly, we've been talking to people, and David is involved. We're thinking to have a satellite flyby where you'll start at Danville and travel the railroad bed so people can see it. If it comes to an invasion, you can check it out. If it comes to a bridge, you can check it out. The technology is such that you can now swing your aeroplane around and look at the bridge from sideways. You can look at the interurban railroad depot and stop off long enough to for people to get an idea. You can back off and look to where the Lincoln Trail is to look for Homer Lake, to look for items that are up to 10 miles off the line, but the sort of thing that bicycle people go to. We have to talk to bicycle people because sometimes they're there for exercise and they're going from A to B, not looking at the details of a prairie, for instance. So how come we can get them to a center that will explain to them what the history is? And surprisingly, they're educated people and they like to find out about things. We're hoping for a way to get through Champaign, way to get from one side of a banner to the other side of Champaign, and to do that in cooperation with active lines that are also active major lines. They're Canadian National lines, and that means if you take a historic train on that corridor, you have to have a pilot. And I'm looking at the clock, and I think we're almost there. So think about these things, and if you have any questions, give us a call at 351-1911, 351-1911, or 840-1911, and we'd enjoy to discuss these things with you and try to simplify the way we present what we have to you and what we might want to do with it and how we might be able to preserve the dignity of the habitat alongside the line. And thank you for listening. This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. And as always, the views and opinions expressed are solely those of the speakers and nobody else. It's a cold day out there, but it's a very clear day. Hopefully folks can get out there and enjoy the bright sunlight shining off of the snow. Well, there's something to it anyway. And it's coming up on noon. You're tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, and it's time for Shruti Music of India. Hurry!